my weight excess. So excess, remember, talk about the reactions that probably happened with no guidance back in the 2-3 billion years ago. How are you gonna have, you know, to push the reaction to one side and add more stuff? So start getting very complicated. So I just expanded here to show this. So in this other article, let me see if this is our, yeah. Every time I touch it, that's all I notice. Oh my goodness. Should I use my mouse instead of my finger in the screen? So he goes back to this article here, the one that he was showing 4 years ago before, and then you can see that it was less than 1%. So just, you know, this is, you know, in chemistry, this is very difficult, you know, to, and say how life in the beginning would go to one direction with much less material available to push to that direction. Very difficult. So, quick picture here to move on. These resolutions are very difficult to execute, to start with in the lab, with all those fancy controlling. It's massive human involvement, which means a lot of knowledge, information, input. To interpret everything is not trivial at all, even for researchers. When you're reading all this, to follow all of this, sometimes things are not presented clearly. So it's kind of complicated to follow through what these people are saying, publishing. Interpretation by the reader, you know, if you're not incisive, even more difficult, right? The layperson doesn't have the expertise to properly interpret the data. Even if you're trying to read the Journal of Organic Chemistry Synthesis, this conceptualization suffers all the time. So it's a big mess. So that's to put it very lightly. So it's very hard to deal with these things in the lab. And people just push this, talk about evolution, like, oh, that's so easy. How it happened? Not really. So, we mentioned petals, so let's give another example. The fancy controlling that exists inside cells. Okay? Let's mention, I think we have photosynthesis. So, ribose is all material to make, you know, stuff. DNA, RNA. The carbon-carbon ring. Remember, 8 possible structures. All of this, you know, DNA, it must use 1 hydroxyl group. This is tricky to see, but hopefully I'll be able to do it. If not, it's not suitable for NA, but less far stable. So this is a lot of big problem, stability and size. So the prebiotic system had no knowledge of any of that. So what's that behind? So it has a blinded pathway to all these products that needs to be made. It must select one that's desired instead of the other one. How does it do that? No. What's the criteria? That's the question. It's hard to know if you don't know the target. This is really complicated. So and who selected? What selected? The selector. Show another quick example here. So these guys, 8 possible, the racemic mixture, all this together in a big soup. No? So we have to go one direction. In a cell, in a lab, for example, chemists can do push to one direction to get down to 50 to 6% yield in the end of this synthesis. If that happens in the cell, that's a lot of trash inside the cell. And what happens? You're intoxicating the cell. Wrong stuff. When man does this, he ends up with 22 other identified species, plus these guys here. So it's really a big task of making things pure. It's hard to make things pure. When you talk about purity, it's a very complicated task. Like you talk about water, for example. I was talking about the morning drive here. You think about water. You drink water, right? What is this? Water. But if you think about chemistry, that's water plus blah, 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 more, a lot of stuff. Like sodium ions, chlorine ions, potassium ions, some nitrates, so nitrogen. So it's a mixture of stuff. To have something, you say, this is 100.000000 water, it's basically impossible. Doesn't exist. If to get water, 99.9999 is expensive water. We have in the lab, but just to create this concept of, you know, purity, what's so it's life, you know, nature doesn't happen at all. So okay, so this kind of yield, they're not going anywhere. One very good example. We got a cell with this, our small building block, right? And we wanna make the big stuff, the real stuff. So we're gonna use one called beta link. We can make different angles to go together. If you go one angle, you got one product. You change the angle, you got different stuff. Simple like that. So you can get starch with one angle, which is the alpha. And okay. So one angle you get starch, different angle you get cellulose. So just this guy, they have to get connection. See, this is complicated because imagine this is not flat like this. This is 3D. So this guy is above the plane, below the plane, they have twisted angles. They all have to go in the right place. So here in the machine, right, you have all this connecting. So this in the cell, you have to put together. But this guy has to connect to the right, because if you connect to any wrong, right, this is all the solution, all this inside the cell. He has to go to the right place. He has to connect it to the correctly, if not, it produces the wrong material. So it has so many branches on this, it can go wrong. You need a super tight control. And here, just one example of steps for the reactions that has to occur and connect it to, you know, each step on the right angle and then separate and connect again. So you have a I'm showing you the right picture, you guys following the size of the task, right? Remember, no control, no target, not knowing where to go, right? Another continuation, the same thing. It's one after the other. In the lab, you have to control. And the cell does that. So, amazingly, right? One angle, you get cellulose. You can build. We're here, this building, this ceiling above us. The other angle, it's food that we just ate in the morning, starch. One mistake, and the cell has to break everything, reduce everything to the initial material. The cell doesn't know how to do that, to fix stuff. So carbohydrate synthesis is exceedingly hard, not easy at all. The coupling of carbon, the putting together, is painstaking work in the lab. Untrained people, like most of us, have no idea how to put this together and perform this synthesis. It's unbelievable. The trained remain clueless of how this could have formed in the prebiotic system. That's the truth. They can guess, they cannot affirm anything at all. But the untrained see little difficulty in conducting the census because, oh, it happens. People in the lab, they're doing this. But we're doing it, but with a lot of control, a lot of knowledge, a lot of technology. And when you think about technology, you can think about man from hundreds of years, knowledge. Now, millions of brilliant people input in this monstrous database of mankind in generating knowledge. And now you're doing this thing, this projector, showing this. What the heck is this? You know, you have any idea how electrons are flowing this screen, generating this? We use them. We think it's easy to make it. Not at all. Very hard. Just imagine now we talk about life. Remember, life can change, reproduce. So, very intelligent machine like this cannot do any of that. Okay, so far, or it's pushing two. I know this is difficult. You know. Okay, at least I'm passing the idea of how hard could life come, you know, to put together all this thing. Okay. I mentioned this last Sunday. I said I'll try to. Just to show this, because this is about 20 years old. The guy who developed this, I forgot his name, probably is going to get a Nobel Prize for this. Now chems are start thinking about using this in the lab, because this is fantastic stuff. I'm going to read just to show how the efficiency inside the machinery. It's unbelievable stuff. It's called carrier-induced spin selectivity. Remember, you have to select. To put things together, you have to make it all. Are we going to use this or are we going to use that? So, how electrons, you know, go in the cell. Because everything we talk about chemistry is flowing of electrons, changing all the time. I'm here talking, that's what's happening inside me. Electrons flowing everywhere. That's the reason we have energy to live. This is exchange of electrons all the time. So, electrons have these properties. They're being negatively charged and they have a spin. A spin means they can point one direction or to the other direction. That's how electrons, they have this thing. So if it's spin up, it has one orientation. If it's down, it's a different orientation. We use these are thumbs, so to show they rotate clockwise or counterclockwise, an analogy. I think he mentioned that Ron Nema and David Waldeck. So they developed this stud and came up with a beautiful thing, you know. Chiral molecules we need. One kind of molecule only. That's what in nature, just reviewing this from the other class. All of our amino acids is all left. So it's only one kind. So unbelievable. How can the 20 different building blocks inside us all spins the light to one direction and not the other? Remember how difficult to make in the lab is to separate these guys. So that's what we have inside ourselves. So look at this. This spin selectivity is very common in ferromagnetic materials, but not in organic stuff. At least we thought. So, but chiral molecules, which they're not magnetic, they can do that. They can select the spin of the electron. What? How they do that? No. This guy, his paper, that's showing him, he talks about how unappreciated the role of chirality in cellular functions today. People are not thinking clearly. So molecules are ubiquitous, control chemistry and yield. So, there is a picture. increasing the picture is showing how the it's helical pitch. You see this would be like electron with one spin, electron with different spin going different directions. So all of this. The cell choose it, you know, with the spin that matches for better yield. So it's like, how they can do that? So, in the, remember, back again, in the human synthesis, you know, when in the lab, making, for example, 100 mer, which is 100 block put together, we can do this DNA synthesis in the lab. It needs 4 steps. The blocking, coupling, capping, oxidation. So all of this, it's a lot of technology and knowledge to do all this. If it generously gives a 99.8% yield per step, that gives a 0.998 to the 400 power, 4 steps and 100 molecules, different ones, put together, gives a 45% yield. The other 55 of unwanted oligos, big other stuff that doesn't interest. So, and then we get all this mass, and then you go to HPLC and page and purify. So how a cell would deal with all this trash inside it? So this is the, we have to get to conclusions. So in cellular system, there's a much higher because of something called spin selectivity. Now, hold on for one more second. I have more difficult stuff here. You get to, this is called hydroxy, right? It has 2 electrons free there. That's parallel singlet surface and a parallel triplet surface. These can go different directions. For example, inside of a beautiful green leaf that we have now in the summer outside, this is happening at an unbelievable speed. And they call photosynthesis. One direction produces oxygen, the other, peroxide. Yeah. So the cell there has all the mechanics, the complex machinery to push to that, and is homochirality is the answer. It's essential for this to happen. So it's transferring to them. The plant survives because it has this from the beginning. Because this long-range electrons inside, it's big. They get super fast, this transfer, because of the chirality structure. It can, it's like a wire. It goes super fast. It goes near the speed of light, the transfer of these electrons inside in the reaction, which is mind-boggling, you know. And it reduces the heat. This is a big problem. When you make reactions, heat has to come in, has to come over and out. And think about how stable our body of cells and plants doesn't produce heat. And the answer is to this guy. It's so efficient in choosing, you know, the best, the more stability, and using less energy. So guys like James Stewart, I mentioned, he is a genius for pi conjugated. So that's his work. He's training, you know, to go through, to put an electron going through homo and lumo, so lower and higher, you know, molecular orbitals. So that's why he published tons of papers on this. So now when they look at this chirality and the spin selectivity, they're like, oh my, we're doing all this hard work for one electron, for one pair of connections between like 2 carbons, for example. And look at this in a plant, in a cell. How homochirality is efficiently a billion times better than we're doing in the lab with just a pi conjugated system. So, beautiful, really beautiful stuff. So, today, 20 years later, so a lot of theoretical papers are suggesting the several orders of magnitude enhancement of electron transfer in one direction over the other when the chirality of the molecule and the spin of the electron are congruent. So this is a machinery that's put together in such a beautiful way that makes life easy. oh, it's easy. So everything is easy when you know how to do it, right? Even put some words together in a crossword or something after you did it. Oh, so easy. Before you had to spend some time thinking. Oh, this is a little bit, you know. So the dipole, so how these things work, it chooses. No, because we induce the dipole interactions, charge Q is transferred from one side of the helix to the other side. And then the other one, the charge goes to the opposite chirality, it speaks to different directions. That's it's showing how it does it, this singlet and triplet. You know. It's like how it's all of this doing there, you know, it's making everything favorable to push to one direction in the most efficient way. So this whole, we call machine, is there. So, summarize again. So, an interselection designates the process of selecting one chiroisomer over another, the left hand or the right hand, remember? High and interselectivity is difficult to obtain in a laboratory, but easy in cells, according to people saying these things on YouTube. So the best of laboratory systems are usually inferior to an enzymatic system. So how does the cell do it? Students have been taught the last 75 years that a preferential molecular fitting causes a molecule to enter into chiral cleft with one preferred orientation. It's a lot of stuff, you know, van der Waals, which is a kind of a force, including steric effects that favor one molecule over the other. You know what else has been generally taught in the last 75 years? So this chiroinductive inductive selectivity reveals that more is going on. It's not just a subtle influence, it's more than that. Look at the comparison. Attractive interaction between molecules in matched chirality can be higher by as much as 1 electron volt or 23 kilocalories per mole, which is an unbelievable amount of energy for a mismatched set. So if you go one way, you extend tons of more energy than to go the other way. It's like you're going to New York City. You just jump on 95, New Jersey Turnpike. It's one energy you're going to spend, like a half tank of gas. But I can go to New York City, going to straight Scranton, Catskills, get back to New York City. We're going to spend a tank of gas, three tanks of gas. Just a quick example, exaggerating. Just to show that the cells, that the system knows how to go to the turnpike. Shoot straight to New York City. It's less energy to do it. So, cells operate in a far more sophisticated way than we think. And this is all new for us. Just resuming, why cells don't overheat? In part, great part of that is because of CISS. You know, because of this channeling of the electrons through the homochirality system, the way the structure is, you know, enhances a lot the saving of energy. So we have no problem with overheating. So imagine this, he gives an example on a macro scale. So these two guys made this nice stud and he compared like a microelectronic processor functioning with the capacity of human brain would need at least 10 megawatts to operate. The same power in our brain can do the same computing with 10 watts. And great part of this is the homochirality system inductive. We use much less energy. If God had made us like we make stuff, we would be human beings would be like a mile tall, like 1,000 feet wide, just to operate, you know, this excess energy, you know, because we're not efficient at all. You know. A little bit like maybe comparing our big engine cars today to the gas tank, maybe with the batteries and the electric motor, a lot more efficient, something like that. But it's still the brain that thinks is a million times, you know, bigger and better. Okay.
Are you saying, in other words, if things happened more randomly, like we'd expect them to in a lab, then we would have to be massive to contain the amount of energy and produce the amount of energy.
Yeah, with the technology
that we
create things.
The way we do.
Yeah, we don't know the best way to for the efficiency. We try our best.
Right.
But if we compare, you know,
if we were trying to create a human in a lab, we'd have to make us a mile high. Too.
Yeah, yeah. Like I mentioned, like if you got made us with the technology, we're using our technology today,
right. We're
gonna be really big,
right.
Because of not efficient at all in terms of spending energy.
I know nothing about this, but I've heard the term: you can lose your electrolytes. That, for instance, you're throwing up and too much, you know, and
sweating, exercising a lot.
Yeah. How does electrolytes? Is this part of our energy in there?
Oh yeah, homeostasis. Electrolytes, as the word electrolyte, is all carrying electrons. They're ions, like sodium. We're all worried about sodium, right? Watch your sodium, don't take too much, blah, blah, blah. It's just this guy flowing, you know, he has one positive charge. And all of this is involved with our energy. We lose that, we go until death. No, a heart stops.
How about the sugar in that? Does that involve any of that too?
Well, sugar is you know, stored in, it creates fat and stores in the it's part of the mechanism to create, you know, store energy.
What improves your electrolytes? Vitamins or energy?
Your body has an amazing way, lots of different mechanisms that it uses to maintain a balance of electrolytes, because you have to have a very narrow range of electrolytes.
Oh, definitely.
So your kidneys are a big part of that, your kidney function, and other systems in your body, your hormones, like your proteins, like he's talking about, your everything, your vitamins that you need, turn on and off genes to affect these. It's like he's saying, this is so complex.
Yeah.
It's unfathomable.
It
is unfathomable.
Like, I'm not going super details with this CISS, but if you go deep and start really studying, you know, the whole car, the structure is in 3D. It's fantastic stuff, twisted. So you can imagine this, you know, the drawing show, it's like a tunnel where the electrons can go and flow on near the speed of light inside the cell machinery. It's more than the sci-fi movies that we watch. It's really high-tech stuff, mind-boggling. But the electrolytes is this. It's part of the energy flow through our body. And it's the controlling. This is a very good word. Control. Everything has to be controlled. If not, you have a problem.
So you can lose them then.
Oh, definitely. Our body knows how to control and stop. No, don't lose too much.
You can stop. Like, you can stop the loss, but if you lose too much, right, then it's hard. You have to replenish.
Yeah. The kidney is probably the biggest example. There's the laboratory that controls electrolytes in our body. It's complex chemistry in the kidney that does that. Questions? Okay. How efficient is our class to the goal I want in the end, like 10%? Hopefully it's 100%.
Well, we don't know what the goal is.
So I was going to ask, that just so I'm following, the main point you're making here that a natural evolutionist maybe would say origin of life, what has randomly come together for there to be life, is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to replicate in a lab with all of these controls on it. So we're to believe that something randomly happened, that with all this technology now, and what can happen in a lab is extremely difficult, if not impossible.
Yeah.
Is that a main point here that you're trying to make?
Part is. Remember, talk about the education system, the intellectual climate, the whole thing. Romans chapter 1, you have to think with all this. When I mentioned that these guys are working hard in the lab, they're not like, oh, those guys are dishonest liars. No, it's not like that. They're good people. A lot of amazing people working hard in that. But they don't know the what's inside us, the real us, you know, how we can misinterpret things that's around it. And the climate in the, today, is, the truth is not the environment anymore. Truth. The truth is for you. The truth is for is different. So that's the environment today. So in science, even though we're trying to add 1 plus 1 equals 2, in this discussion is more forensic, because all these examples we see in the lab, but we don't know what happened in the beginning. Oh, but if it did something similar, but even the similar, remember the examples in the papers, how there's dishonesty there, a little bit.
There's assumption.
Assumptions, yeah. Assumptions.
All over the place.
Assumption is number one, God doesn't exist. Or let's keep God out of science. The data is this. Somehow, we were put together with no force, no intelligence behind this. So that's the forensic is controlled by the primal interpretation with there is no God. So somehow, these things got together. And using time as a part of the 4 billion years, probably is enough time. But even that, you can go to the lab and do some work showing that 4 billion years is not enough at all to create life. Because of all this complicated stuff that we, more and more we dig, you know, slowly, you know. This is just 20 years old. If I had this discussion in the 90s, this would never be mentioned when we thought we knew stuff. And it's always it's coming some new stuff that makes it like, wow, life is really unbelievable. So that's, go ahead.
So is another point to be made here that there should be some humility? In other words, you know, we trust the science, you know, well, what is that, you know, it's changed.
Remember that the more the guy knows, the more he's careful to say things and affirm others. He's more like, maybe. Remember, I would joke like, I don't want to lose my grants, but somehow this happened. So he's more careful. People who don't know, they repeat like, you know, blah, 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 blah. Like, and those are the guys spreading more. Teachers in high school, not saying negative things against them, but no less, and that's what happens more. YouTube guys, YouTubers are famous for spreading things that are not true at all. Or it's part is true, but remember, this is a lot. The science of the beginning is a lot of forensic stuff there. It's, we have some of this information here, how you project this 4 billion years ago. So the environment, this is, remember, we mentioned this, what's prebiotic relevant? We might make something in the lab. It might even make something, oh, this can go to life, direct. But is this relevant? This is a big problem. A lot of the papers published, people talk, it's not relevant because what was there in the beginning with no control, no goal, no target? It doesn't make a difference you make in the lab. that's the thing, you know. To put this together, think with it, what was there? And was there? Who knows it?
We're just trying to figure it out. We didn't even figure out how to make it. We're just trying to figure out what it is. Right? We can't even figure out what it is.
Yeah.
Our immune system, my immunology professor said, we probably don't even know 1% about the immune system.
How did the thing work?
It's just, you know, we can do so much with it.
And then we're starting to talk about chemistry. And then we can get this guy to talk about physics, which is maybe before chemistry, because, in the beginning there was a Big Bang, energy exploded 13.5 billion years ago, and coalesces this energy into hydrogen atoms, then fused to a helium, they formed a star, and after 3 billion years, the star got heavy, exploded with making heavier elements, and then those dust put together and then form a planet. So, not even get to this point. That's another talk, you know, completely different. This is just the chemistry on Earth that we look at. That's it. Now, it's easier in one sense. But if you go to astrophysics, they're discovering all kinds of stuff. I was just reading about how there's a shield, probably a few years ago. The sun, has a magnetic field. But actually, in the end of the solar system, when it was Voyager, it got outside, they found out that the sun creates another shield that goes all the way to the end of the solar system. Like, whoa! So it's like, then you can go, that is a beautiful, Gonzalez writes a lot about the fine tuning of physics, astronomy, it's a beautiful thing, you know, to look at.
So I have a question.
Sure.
As a non-science person, and the only science, well, that I know of that I took is chemistry, high school chemistry, by the way, and I only remember valence tables, I think, and I only remember that because I had to pass a test, but I don't remember anything now other than that word, valence. And H2O water, yeah, I do remember that. So, but here's my question. Forget.
Sure.
I'm trying to make a joke, but I'm not doing very well.
We're laughing.
When I hear scientific information through the news or whatever, how much stock should I put in that? And I'm not being critical. When I say I'm not being critical now, I'm just saying, should I really believe it or should I just kind of toss it out? It's about some scientific. How much stock should I put in?
Well, as I mentioned, it's a lot of serious people working hard. And we can see this, you know, we go to the lab, we have nice medicine to heal us, we can, surgeons know how to go to our brain, pull out a tumor from there. It's an amazing thing, you know, that it's been developed for us. We can go on a plane, sit there, watch a movie, and fall asleep, eat a nice meal, you know. You're not worried that the technology is going to fail. No. Something like that, you know. So a lot of good work made by, you know. Actually, remember that God gave all this to us. And, you know, being a good engineer, a good chemist, is a gift from God. Don't forget this. This is a blessing to mankind. Even blessed to the church. I started reading a book, Tony Rank. God, Technology, and Christian Faith. It's really worth it to read it. It's a really great book. It's a lot of theology. It's a technology, but he gets like Isaiah chapter 54, which is coupled, you know, with Isaiah 53, which is the beautiful thing about the Redeemer there. And then he talks about the Ravager that God creates for destruction. Wait a minute. And the smith, the blacksmith that makes the iron, the steel. Oh, it wasn't steel back then. And this together, God puts these things together to wipe a whole city, a whole civilization. Because we tend to think about theology and we spiritualize things, right? We don't want to think about the guy going to the city of Texas, killing 21 people, children. Now, God is not involved at all with that. But if you look at the Bible, God is completely involved with that. You know, with the R-15, you know, the AR-15 rifle, the engineers who developed that, and we call stupid, evil, whatever, 18-year-old boy who did all this thing. So it's hard to put this together because of all the pain, the sadness, the nastiness of the whole thing. God, it is. So the technology that put the nails on Jesus' cross, made by a blacksmith, carried out by evil Roman soldiers, is all under God's control. And the Silicon Valley, Elon Musk, is all under God's control. It's hard to pinpoint and get that, you know, but it is. When you look at the scriptures, that bring us great relax. You know, God's in control, even though it's coronavirus, you know, all this death, more than a million deaths in the country. Was it natural for man, or is manipulated by man in the lab? We don't know, maybe we never know.
So this is so helpful to remember, like the sovereignty of God over all this, because with regards to your question, and like, should I trust what I see coming from science? It's mixed. There's a lot of practical application, like he's saying. Like, you can take medicine and lower your blood pressure. But when you take medicine to lower your blood pressure, you're also affecting other systems in your body, what we call side effects, right? So there's always, like, we can get close enough to solve our problems, but we can't get to perfection, right? And so, is there corruption in science? There's some of that, too. Yeah, there's money involved, right? But there's also this sense of, like he's saying, like, good scientists doing good work, and it's still not going to come out perfect. And we find that sometimes assumptions that we've had for a long time end up being wrong. So,
very
to
good.
Remember God's sovereignty it's over all of this
excellent.
Is really, really good.
Excellent. And the point behind you start mentioned before, because we do know 1%. We take the blood control medicine, right? But then we have some other strange stuff. That's because we don't know how the whole complex system works. Mm-hmm. So we make a drug that's we call side effect because yeah. it means it doesn't
work.
It might
save your life
still,
though, right? It might save your life still.
It might save your life right? temporarily, so. But it might bring something else later down the
right.
road, which means we don't have the. Remember, this 100.000% knowledge is very tricky. We don't have that. Mm-hmm. So that's reason science. You can. Oh. Now, I just read this story that medicine for our heart, for men, it has to be different for women because they discovered that woman's heart operates a different way. What the heck? It's just a pump. It's just a pump. It's a lot of chemistry there. So it's so just one single thing to show, you know, how to trust science. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was a famous German scientist. He lived around 1760 to 1840. His name was von Humboldt. You heard of the von Humboldt current.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the first scientist to really, he was very, very good, very technical, and he traveled through South America and North America, and he measured and he took temperatures at different heights, and he traveled in valleys. The first one to talk about the problems of environment, you know, destroying trees and problems created. And the summary of his work, finally, he went from the macro to the micro, and it was called The Cosmos, and he wrote this thing in around 1847. All the famous people of the day wanted it. Everybody wanted this book. Darwin had a copy. All these famous people had copies. He did the whole thing without any reference to God. There's no reference to God in the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
Beautifully illustrated pictures, diagrams of mountains and valleys. So at that point, you have to say, what's wrong with this picture as a Christian? You know, what we know from scriptures, there's something wrong. That you can, he was just the beginning of these men that wanted to create a world without God. But he was a scientist. I mean, he was very detailed and he was a great, great man in his day. The British would not let him go to India. He wanted to go to India, but they didn't want the Germans to get too much glory. So they never let him, so he had to go to Russia. He went all the way to Russia, all the way across Russia and back. But anyways, the kind of thing we have to say to ourselves.
Yeah.
How can we do all this without
the reference? And adding to that a little bit is how God uses what people never glorify God, never mention God, and God uses that because that's going to apply to this and to that. It's going to branch up, you know, it branches off to different stuff that brings God, you know, to the point where he wanted. So this is everywhere. And science is this. It's a some human enterprise. Bunch of sinners doing stuff together. Some is gonna be good, great stuff, some not so good, or some could be even evil. We develop nuclear energy, great stuff, right? You might develop an atomic bomb. Devastating weapon. So and so on. It's just us. But let me go to the summary here. So, just see if we got it. What time is it? So, did homochirality in cells arrive after cellular life started? Some people were suggesting this. And he answers it beautifully, you know, using the spin selectivity, you know, come on. You have a massive racemic stuff in the cell. You're not going anywhere. You have to have homochirality from the beginning. And as we saw, homochirality is hard to begin with. You know, to purify this stuff in the lab is hard work. And it's not trivial at all. So there's a vast numbers of electron transfer taking place in lipid bilayer membranes. So it's basically to imagine a world without homochirality from the beginning. I skipped them. One of the things I skipped because it would be almost another, also like a class for each of those subjects and lipid, you know, layers. It's unbelievable. I think we mentioned the next two or three Sundays the channels for how water gets inside the cell and out, all the clipping mechanisms with electrons, protons, it's just unbelievable. It's like a valve that would open up and close, just protons doing that. A proton is a nuclear subpart, it's not an atom, it's just a much, much smaller than an atom. And it's part of this world doing stuff. How did proteins noted above, come to Homo caro when there is no prebiotic relevant root? So this is really amazing stuff for people involved with this research to produce anything. No evidence for any of the claimed racemic mixtures. This is, he summarized what's in the, in the media, in the books, YouTube videos. They don't show how, the things function from the basic reactions, the specificities of the systems, yields, heat management. So it's just crazy machine cellular stuff. Like so much that promoted by those speaking about the chemicals of life's orange, there are incorrect claims that make the chemicals of life appear easy. So that's the thing that unfortunately is there. Do the organic chemists who study orange life appreciate these fallacious proclamations? Probably not. But some don't care, or most maybe don't care. So all of this makes the layperson misled, and it's pretty hard. Part of this class is just to help the church to not to be misled. That's part of the goal. Orange of life science is very difficult because we have to use a lot of assuming stuff.
Case in point, I have a degree in chemistry, and I did not know that there were no racemic mixtures used in cells. I didn't know that.
If you look, you're dead. So that's it. More questions? Let's talk. Next class is going to be now. Okay. What about information?
Can you write down the book that you mentioned?
Which one?
The book that you mentioned.
Technology.
Tony Rank. God, Technology, and Christian Faith. That's a good book. It is a really great book. I think I should read that. It's really amazing.
There's another one. Eric Metaxas has a recent book out. I don't know if you've seen that one. I just started to share a little bit of it. He deals with, it's a kind of a reaction to the Time magazine, back in the 70 or something. Is God dead? And he wrote a book, Is Atheism Dead? And he goes over the science in layman's terms, but then he includes archaeology and all kinds of other things to show that the more we learn like this, the more we realize that atheism's dead.
So this is the chemist before biology. So the next step is complicated also because we're gonna get information. And okay, people are saying, oh no. Evolution happens, we see it. Okay, what do we see? As we mentioned, that one way is to characterize life is we change. Mm-hmm. And we see this, things change. That's what Darwin saw a lot in his research. Mm-hmm. How do you conclude what his conclusion went to? Where, if you read his book, it's marvelous to see how in the beginning he was these things is against God, against Christianity that he grew up in England. Then you keep reading his stuff, he started going to change. From the book, the first publishing his research in 1859, right? All the way down to a few years before his death. You can see how much he changed in terms of be a little bit careful of what he was saying to forget God. I think we're going to the right direction, oh God. He had a good point in saying that if we don't find the simple stuff all the way to complex, my theory is dead. Now we are 150 years later, Yeah, we haven't found anything yet.
Do you know if it's true? I've heard that he expressed reservation or regret for some of his claims on it, you know, at the very end of his life. I don't know if that's true.
People trying because someone in his family was Christian, his father was a pastor or something.
Okay.
But I think it's kind of more myth or something.
Okay.
Yeah, I heard that too.
Yeah, I think same with pasture or something too, right?
Yeah.
Because we understand now the importance of probiotics, right?
Uh huh. Yeah, if Darwin knew all the camps that we know today, probably he would,
right.
The way he was honest in the beginning, probably mm-hmm. would say, oh, forget all this, right. What I'm saying, you know, I hope so. Anything else? Good, Steve?
I think one thing Darwin said was that, you know, his theory would fall apart if, basically he was saying there's not enough fossils found yet. Prove his theory. And
the fossil record is a problem for evolution.
Big problem. Yeah.
We're going to talk about the Cambrian explosion.
Yeah.
How in one layer, boom, life is there. So we're going to talk about that.
Could you maybe recommend some videos? I know you talked about James Tour. He's got some great videos. Maybe next week bring us some links or something.
Well, we're going to start next week with a video.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, that'll be great stuff. You know, it's so good, like, well, let's start a class with it. It's a 20-minute video, and then we put questions, we develop on the top of that. Because it's great, though, Steve Mayer, Hub, and Michael B., those guys from Discovery Institute, they made a super nice video. It's just a very honest conversation. They're not imposing anything, you know. Discovery Institute doesn't have, you don't have to be Christian to be part of that. You can be Jewish, Muslim, whatever. It's just an honest scientist saying, hey, the data, modern data, is pointing to different directions. Are you willing to go to where the data is taking you? So that's the question.
There's also there's a website called creation.com. It's got like thousands of articles.
Yeah, you have different groups, right? Discovery, it's not fighting for like young Earth creationists or guys from Logos, now believe in evolution, everything. They're Christian evolution theists, let's say. They're more like focusing, showing to the world like what science has now is not enough for this conclusion that they're having showing in the educational system. That's what a lot of young people are leaving church with their faith, because science has proved that there's no God. There's no Bible, so crap stuff. No, literally, that's what we're saying. We don't need those faith anymore. Because
the other thing too is that both sides have their biases.
Both sides have biases.
Both sides.
It's hard to be unbiased.
Yeah. And you know, all these James Tour and all these other guys, I mean, they've got their biases just as
much
as Darwin's and then the other guys.
Yeah. I think the thing is, when we read 1 Peter 3, one way to honor Christ in our heart without being too spiritual, Peter says, you have to give a good reason why do you believe the way you believe. That's how you honor Christ. But you know, you should know this stuff, so you can give a good answer. And then he says then, with gentleness. So we're going to talk a lot of this, and so I'm like, no, I completely disagree. It has to be a lot of gentleness and kindness, you know, how to talk about this stuff. Because we don't know anything. They don't know everything, we don't know everything too. So. But we have the Bible in our hands, so our position is like, I can look at this guy, the seal of this, how much I get in, you know, to me, how much I buy into this. But then we have the church, we have to watch and protect the church. So I have to give a good balanced material for the church to read and say, oh, okay, you know. not pushing to one side. If we stuck our heels in one side, we'd never be able to bridge to the other side. Never. So then that's our political situation today. Left and right, and we don't want to talk. Your view is wrong about the world completely. That's how wars happen. We don't want to have this. We can. The first article, that guy, he mentioned, developed very well all of that and showed how in evangelical church today, it's producing this, two fields separated, affecting how the church thinks about several of the modern issues. It's all connected.
Daniel, could you generate some kind of reading list that people could...
For books? Okay. Yeah. Maybe not for next Sunday.
No,
not
but
for
eventually.
Through the course,
And also, would you include videos on there, as Steve mentioned, in that list?
Yep.
Please.
Very good. Yeah, because you can have time at home, you can sit down and take some notes, stop the video, it's much better. Hearing good is, can talk and interact with each other. Steve, can I pray so we can finish?
Yeah, let's pray. Well, God, I do thank you so much for your incredible creation that is right in front of our face everywhere we look. Thank you for Daniel putting all this together for us. Thank you for each person here. Lord, we pray that you would guide us into the truth, that most of all we would love you and trust you and believe your word. Lord, I do pray for all of us here as we consider these things and New Life Church as well, that you would help us. Point us to yourself, Lord, in every way. Thanks for worship, Lord. Thank you for the gospel. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Dan. Yeah. How's everybody doing today? Good?
Yeah.
All right. So let's start it. I'll volunteer for prayer. We ask God for us to help us to understand some difficult things so we can glorify Him better.
I'll pray.
Lord, we thank you for this world that you've made. Lord, we know it's not the way it should be, but we thank you for it and the beauty of it. We know, Lord, we're not the way we should be, but we thank you that you've redeemed us and you're working in us through your Spirit. And so we just commit to you this morning and what we're going to learn. Be with Daniel, bless him, and teach us something that we didn't know before. And we just thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Quick review. There are four people, four or five people who were not here last Sunday. And for us to refresh before we start adding more stuff to what we saw last Sunday. So we covered a little bit before we talk about abiogenesis, the intellectual climb of our days. So we started by reading Romans chapter 1, when we saw that clearly God says, because God has shown it to them, makes everyone inexcusable. So this is really great to start with, keeping this in mind all the time, that God has shown to them, to us, to everyone, what he has done. So no excuse. So we came quickly to this point to show that how modern philosophy influence everything in our culture, so down to our theology. So you split the seminaries, you split the churches in the late 1800s, 1900s, in the U.S., major denominations left basically biblical Christianity into something else that Paul called it. It's not the gospel, it's something else, whatever you're going to call it. So, and this actually is even more complicated than we think, because it has gone into everything in our culture. We start even thinking as Christians, like, with some of the tools that they give to us. We don't even know, but we go to school, we learn. So this is kind of, this Schaefer in the book, Escape from Reason, he develops this whole thing about showing that how modern man doesn't use reason anymore. It's just a hopeful thing that in the future we might learn something that will really give us what we can call the truth, but modern man just gave up truth altogether. And then we developed a little bit of idea where that came from Germany, analytical stuff, versus the continental philosophy, how all of this is in science, analytical philosophy had a hope to help better chemistry and physics, but actually everything is falling apart in today's world, and not much room for truth anymore. So science, as we go to the lab to work, truth is not the field anymore. We're not much interested in truth, even though we're supposed to add 1 + 1 has to be equal to 2. But then we talk about science of the beginning, and then there's a lot of forensic science there. And forensic science, you get some data here, and then you have to project in the back, and there's a lot of stuff in the middle that you put a lot of bias to interpret it. So most of what we see today is all influenced by that. All of this, I didn't give you the credit from last Sunday, is a paper from Costello, from Patios.com. So I think that for you, it's a nice platform for discussion. And it's everybody writes and discuss, even Muslims, Hindus, everybody. This is an interesting platform for discussing. Okay. So, and we finish up, I show this picture of Philadelphia, 1861. And I mentioned that it's quite interesting that those people sitting there, this Abraham Lincoln welcomed Kansas to the Union. And those people are farther away from us than they are to the biblical characters, Abraham, Jacob. Those guys think closer to them than they think to us. Just to show the big gap that we have philosophically, theologically, and I think everything changed in the world when man discovered electricity and started handling electrons. That's another world, literally. We cannot live without electricity. We don't even think about it because we have no food without electricity. We have nothing without electricity. So the world today is a world moved by electricity. And that changed a lot of stuff. Like how we, basically it's two different worlds. That's what I would say. Okay, so let's go back then to our subject. Quick review too. I will talk about water. So our discussion is about abiogenesis. So we start defining what it is. It is the origin of life from non-living matter. So there's nothing there. It's just some molecules, very simple guys, like water, CO2, methane, ammonia, and those guys that we call the basic building blocks. They have come together. Look at this. Maybe you can squeeze a little bit.
Unless you want to just make a full screen, I think it might fix itself. Yeah, make the slideshow. Like start the slideshow.
Ah, okay. So what else?
There you go.
Then we came to the point where we have to define life. So what's life? So we saw that it has to respond to the environment. It grows, it changes. It has the ability to reproduce, metabolism, it breathes, maintain homeostasis, which is an amazing thing of complex energetic equilibrium in the body. But then we start thinking about what's a prebiotic chemistry. It's a chemistry that existed before everything. So simple stuff there. No control of everything. The theories are like oxygen atmosphere, no oxygen, so different ideas. Temperature, too hot, too cold, probably too hot, most likely. So the Earth conditions, that's what we mentioned quickly. And how these simple things here, how they have to come together to form the bigger building blocks, which are polysaccharides, proteins, nucleic acid, lipids, all of this stuff, it's us, you know, we're made of large blocks now, that's what I talk about, not the sand grain. Think about a house, for example. Those are the big blocks, not the sand. The sand would be the methane, the water, you know, tiny little grain, just to make a picture. Then, well, let's skip this. I mentioned what which one of these are, and then put some picture of what we have in the lab compared to the early Earth, which had nothing like that. So making life a lot more difficult for the Mr. Evolution to create stuff. You know. So then I quickly took another good example that evolution is something like this. We get all these parts and spread all over the planet. Put a wheel in the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, the other one we put in the North Pole, and it's all just spread them around. And then we're gonna ask somebody who has never seen a car, we don't give them a blueprint, anything, to go find those parts and put the car together. And what's the chance for that to happen in 100 years for the life? Where is, let's say that your great-great-grandpa lived 100 years. So what's his chance to put this car together in his lifespan? So it's like, just start building up the problem, the size of the problem. So we spread now to the universe, the car parts, because actually a rim, a car, a tire with the metal part is a very complex building block already, because it's not ore, no, iron ore. It's already man developing all this steel technology to make the rim. And the tire is not the oil down the ground, it's the oil brought back, separated, polymerized with sulfur to make, you know, all the technology for a tire is specific, you know, the size of how thick it is, how long, the strength, all of this is a lot of, you know, information stuck in the stupid wheel. So it's already a big building block. Just to, so it's the idea was to make the problem, just to show the size of the problem. And now if something happened, then you have a big problem, because no, everything has a tendency to go back to the simple guys. So back to the iron ore. The steel is too complicated, and there's a lot of energy to keep that. So that's how nature works. So we call this the synthesis problem. we summarize, molecules don't care about life. Simple like that. Organisms care. Cells, the big machine in the cell, is fighting to keep us alive. It has a lot of information there. That's where, but simple molecule, basic chemistry, is not life. Doesn't care at all about that. So some joke about it. And the present situation with education, what we see out there, a quickly survey showing that 40% would believe that, you know, we have came to the point the science can figure out, create a complex life form like a frog. And the bacteria, even 72% of the population believe that it's possible to make a bacteria in a lab. So, what we have is this in the world, pushing through the educational system that's, you know, our children is just assimilating this. You know, we grow up with this, we breathe this in the movies and everything, you know, around us, that somehow already science has figured out how life happened, and we stopped here. So our next step is going to be a little more complicated, because now we start pinpointing some of these problems with a little bit more chemistry. You have to bear with me, there's going to be even more chemistry here. Okay, just to kind of nail really down to say, wow, what you talk about now, I start seeing what you're saying. You know, I think the car scenario is going to help a lot to go through this. There's more chemistry now, and there's no time to cover all of this. Remember, this is summarizing a 13-14 hour class from Dr. James Tour. If you want to go into there, you can see all of this, and I'm seeing much, much, million times better. but James Stewart. He's answering a guy criticizing his work, you know. And then he pinpoints every part of the critique and creates a class showing what this guy is saying. And he gets material, and we're going to show some of that. So I think it's pretty nice to cover more in detail homochirality. And it's a huge problem for abiogenesis. So I mentioned quickly, we start mentioning again, homochirality, what is it? It's that in molecules, in chemistry, we have something that chiral or asymmetry, you know, is when a hand, we put in the mirror, the image there doesn't fit your right hand because it's left. Like a glove, you cannot get a left-hand glove and put it in your right hand, it won't fit. So with molecules, that happened too. So we call them chiral molecules. So like an example is 2-butanol. This is the where they start is the asymmetric center. So it's very important for life, and that's how you're going to slowly build up on that. So just for you to have an idea, it looks like they're exactly the same thing, right? They have the same components. But when you try to put them together, they won't fit. See, the hydrogen goes to a different spot. So it ended up being different, literally. It has different melting point, different solubility. So they're, you know, in chemistry they call congruents, enantiomers, things like that. So life depends on this a lot. So because of what? You know, I showed one example of one molecule with one of this chiral center. What happens in life is that I have molecules with more than one chiral center, which make our problem bigger. And then you're gonna get bigger, you know, we're gonna climb the steps of difficulty. So let's go through this. For example, the next level is just one center, we're gonna have two centers. Two centers, well, one example, the name of this guy, 2-pentanediol. So now instead of two guys different from one center, now it's 2-2-N. That's the so if you have two, now it's 2^2, we're gonna have 4 guys. This is the same stuff. Look at this. It's all exact same stuff. But actually now we have 4. It's like, what? 4 guys are different. They're not the same stuff. You cannot, as I gave an example, one can be a medicine to heal you, the other can be a big problem for you. So this is 2. So when you have one center or enantiomers, they have the same melting point physical properties. Diastereomers, they are different, which make us, for chemists, easier to separate them. So just have to get these 2 concepts, okay? So with one, it's easier to make, separate, and then the other. So let's get this guy here now, because this is a good part of life. It's basically on the top of this. This is a pentose sugar. Pent, it's 5 centers of the word pentose, 5 carbons. So it has 3 of those centers, right? So now I have 8 possible isomers. 8. Okay, remember they're mirror images of the of each other. They're all chiral, so it means they're non-superimposable images. So we don't know the target. So this, let's assume this is inside the possible cell. Where to go? There's no target, no control of where this guy's going to go. So it's mixture of these things is very problematic for a reaction synthesis. A mixture of these things we call racemic mixture. So separate these guys, right? How chemists they do this? It's not a trivial task at all. Remember I mentioned enantiomers have, you know, identical melting point and boiling point in solubility and something else, some other physical properties. So to separate these guys is very tricky. So the strategy is to convert an enantiomer into a stereomer. So that's what people do in the lab. So not an easy task, right? So we use chirochromatography, we use diastomeric salt formation, a selective crystallization. So all of this is a lot of information control in order to go to one direction. Remember, target, goal, where to go, where you want to go. Remember, Mr. Evolution doesn't know any of that. So somehow he figured. A selective crystallization is just one example thing, right? A solution of a mixture of these guys cooled to a supersaturation, and a seed crystal of the desired enantiomer is added. That's how you start guiding. So the seed crystal serves as the resolving agent and promotes the crystallization. That's how people do in the lab. So you get to the right enantiomer, so the process is performed in large scale by pharmaceutical companies, for example, because they want to make your medicine high yield and not a mix of stuff. In the past, there are lots of problems that happened. There's a famous case back in the mid-1900s. I forgot the name of the disease. So the medicine was synthesized with the two compounds together and start killing people. And that's when they figured out that isomers don't have the same property. Mm. Now, here I'm going to give a little bit of example that James Stewart gives, because remember, he's answering a critique to his work. And then he says, look how the environment in science is today. With internet, with YouTube, people are putting a lot of stuff. That, remember, I showed that little curve, Kruger, that people think they know, usually young people, and they just are contributing to the confusion of the public. So here he gets this example. He sees the guy criticizing him, says, so he stopped, like, okay, let me get all the, what his source of what he's talking about. So he gets one of the paper the guy quotes, right? And then the guys mentioned the predominant of racemic. Remember, racemic is a mixture of all the isomers together. Overformation, a conglomerate of homochirocrystals from a liquid of non-equilibrating enantiomers, is an outstanding, unexplained fact in organic solid-state chemistry. So that's how he gets this article and showing where this guy is going to. So. Here he's mentioned that racemic crystals are predominantly, but not exclusively, more stable and more dense. So got these things. Denser crystals are predominantly more stable, but there is no quantitative correlation between that. So he starts pointing to the idea of when. Remember, I talk about the crystallization, right? Crystal has to go down. So it's wait a minute. When this happens, the crystals that form usually 9 to 1 or even more is all them together, not separate. They're not separated. So what this guy's talking about? So he points to the paper, and the guy says, no, we did this in the lab, so somehow, it happened because we did this. And then he points out that how people go to spread things that are not correct. But remember, I mentioned that people don't know correctly. Sometimes they kind of cover it up a little bit when they're publishing papers. He used the term a slight excess of asparagine in the synthesis, 2,700%. I dislike excess. It's 2,100%. Okay. Playing with the language, huh? Then in the whole article, there's no indication at all of yield. Never mentions yield. Because that's very important. When you make something, you're going to say how much we made. Well, after all the work we did, we got 1%, but that's not going to take work. But how much money are you going to make if you try to make a candy, but whatever kind of sweet stuff, right? And you have to put so much sugar there, so much sugar, and then in the end, you get 1% of the sweet stuff in there. But it doesn't work, right? It's not logical. So it's a little bit like that, you know. And then all of this work of these guys is on the top of another paper in 2001. So, here another example, another product, the reagent that he used, 300% fit,